Chapter 6, General Unknown, Spring 1979. Brooklyn looked like his eyes were about to pop, a non-medical description, although accurate. His protruding eyes, that exothalamus thing, could have been described as eyelid retraction, or more directly as Marty Feldman disease. Originating in the New York City borough of Queens, his odd Brooklyn nickname was actually misplaced by about 10 miles. Ancestrally, he belonged to a succession of engravers and merchants. Circa 1960, his relatives were pleased to see Brooklyn's direction toward the chemical profession. At a neighboring child's bar mitzvah, a middle-aged uncle, noted Brooklyn's tremor, felt his wrist to discover a fast, racing pulse. Inquiring how the boy felt, the response might have been expected. "I feel like I'm going 100 miles per hour, Uncle Bernie. Hey, your eyes pop out just like mine." A family physician gave his disease a name memorable for two reasons, Graves and disease. Like other Bayside boys, he registered for selective service, but when ordered for an Army physical, the examiner quickly disqualified him. Perhaps not the best of news, or was it? No likelihood of dying on the Korean Peninsula or Vietnam-era recalls. Matriculating at New York University, he opted for an advanced course in synthetic chemistry. Some of his disease characteristics, perhaps the ones that drove academic obsession, translated into early successes. Armed with a 1975 PhD, Brooklyn joined the corporate chemistry world under the aegis of Louisiana-based Big River Corporation, the world's largest producer of gasoline additives. Had he been posted to more genteel corporate offices in Richmond, a quite different outcome might have ensued. Instead, he was dispatched to Shreveport. Reporting to work in Big River's research facility, Brooklyn established residence in nearby Bossier City. Bossier, as the locals quipped. To say he was misplaced understated the issue. One day, as he shared a beer, maybe two, with an African-American cutting grass, neighborhood snoops detected the schism between his values and theirs. Whether due to his irrepressible hyperthyroidism or his front porch beer, Brooklyn's Bossier course shortened. Per the era, the best tool for job-changing chemists was a weekly trade journal known as Chemical and Engineering News, a publication that could as easily have been labeled Chemical and Engineering Jobs. Like other features of his life, job termination presented an unplanned and thyrotoxicotic issue. Brooklyn pinched the latest issue of CNE News from the Big River Library as he left Louisiana, and possibly the most recognizable car ever driven there, a Citroen DS. Tracking north along US 71, he made it to Pittsburgh, NOH, Kansas, where the DS water pump expired, shortly seeking a reservation at the venerable Stillwell, a hotel boasting air conditioning and asbestos fireproofing. Begging mercy on the desk, he introduced himself, emphasizing his doctor qualification. While reviewing a list of unreserved rooms, the desk clerk inquired, "What kind of doctor are you?" Brooklyn's answer was accurate, although dense. Organometallic synthetic chemistry. While only the last of those terms registered, the clerk's response reflected the candor and openness that made small town life refreshing, but other times oppressive. "That would make you our second out-of-town visitor for the open chemistry spot." Alone in his hotel room, Brooklyn placed a copy of CNE News on his chest while entertaining a brief nap. Later that evening, as he paged through its listings, he eventually spotted a locally originated notice. Research chemist, one adapted to teaching multiple sessions of general and organic chemistry, industrial and teaching experience preferred. Forward names of three references and a curriculum vitae to Pittsburgh State University. Vexed at being released, Brooklyn had exacted retribution by monopolizing the Xerox room there on his last day in Shreveport, photocopying reference letters. He not only copied his curriculum vitae, but also generously invested in photocopies of two obscure journal articles partially attributable to his efforts, wedging these career-relevant documents into a black sales phallus. Brooklyn made the case more generic, using a black Sharpie to obscure gilded lettering that had previously announced Big River Chemicals. By lunch on his first Pittsburgh day, he delivered names of three references and his resume. He considered himself fortunate to have met two chemistry professors as well as some of their Eagle Pitcher colleagues who worked in the immediate area. Apparently, Eagle Pitcher Industries owned lead production facilities in nearby Joplin, Missouri, and also in the Oklahoma border town of Pitcher. The firm possessed a distinguished record of mining, refining, and production of high-purity lead compounds. The professors included Brooklyn in dialogues during each of the 5 days required for a rebuilt Citroen water pump to be bussed in from the nearest dealer, one doing business in Boston. While the local professors welcomed his interest, Brooklyn noted that Pittsburgh currently lacked endocrinology expertise. Hence, his new professor friends helped him by referring Brooklyn to colleagues at the University of Kansas City, 100 miles to the north. Kansas City, similar to other chemical producers like Midland, Michigan, and Wilmington, Delaware, shared in the legacy of three-per-day syntheses. Some Kansas City entries became useful in agriculture, while others aided polymer manufacturing. Armed with those photocopies and a blacked-out sales valise, Brooklyn pointed his water-pumping Citroen north, arriving 4 hours later at a second-tier Kansas City hotel, the Genie, one offering cheap weekly rates and room service as long as Chinese food sufficed. He shortly ferried 5 soiled dress shirts to Ross Miller Dry Cleaners, a plant located east of Kansas City's downtown. The Miller Lobby was a place he could test communication skills in a place vastly different than Queens, New York. Similar to his Pittsburgh experience, he sought collegiality from Kansas City professors. A senior chemistry colleague there initiated a call relay, passing the baton to the department chair, who identified their anchor man, the dean. Everyone liked the irrepressible New Yorker, and a schedule to interview him for a teaching position was shortly organized. Ross Miller Cleaners wasn't intimidated by Brooklyn's dried Tabasco stain on the suit, performing similar miracles for his blue interview suit. His light blue Henri dress shirt evenly absorbed median starts. The college shortly hired him, noting its good fortune to attract an NYU chemist. Evaluations from his first or even second term of lecturing presented a disappointing picture. In fairness, the waxing and waning energy characteristics plus effects of multiple medications created an uneven, scattered lecture. He also generated some questions of his own. Why were all these students pre-something? And what was he, a warm-up act for professional schools? Collegial opportunities fell short of Brooklyn's expectation. A neighboring botanist, Mel something, mainly cataloged ferns. However critical Brooklyn's studies may have been to three-per-day syntheses, they were also narrowly focused, perhaps shortchanging him in the liberal aspects of either arts or sciences. USMC Mel's profession and devotion were similarly directed, the science of plants, ferns in particular. He didn't mind his nickname, but was quick to correct anyone finding it cute to refer to him as a marine biologist. Mel had waded ashore to intense fighting on Okinawa. When he arrived there, only a few palm trees stood, and before his 6 Marines departed, no vegetation remained. From Easter 1945 forward, Mel's primary mission became one of defeating what he considered as the joint obscenities of deforestation and defoliation. Mel was spending another afternoon pressing fern specimens into newsprint pages. Past 55 and nearing 60, he captured most of Missouri's species, but Missouri was only one among of many places, leaving 10,000 additional fern species unpressed. In addition to new finds, Mel scrolled through older entries, finding solace in their diversity and their beauty. The aroma of fern specimens pressed into damp newspaper pages ranges from pleasant to neutral. But what Mel smelled could better be described as vile or sulfurous, an odor originating about 40 feet away. Students down that hallway were performing a time-honored experiment, one termed identification of a general unknown, in the process creating an irritating toxic sulfur odor, one that did more than irritate his nostrils. It reminded Mel of burnt hair and charred flesh. A young chemistry assistant, Racer, presided over that odd hell miniature, one in which 18 meeker burners heated water baths, limiting reaction temperatures to the boiling point of water, each assembly relying on a series of 5 to 8 test tubes, each one of those spiked with a sulfur-containing compound. They all freely generated hydrogen sulfide, or as chemists shortened the term, H2S. However anonymous science buildings might have appeared to others, their occupants could readily identify one another according to great gait patterns. Racer was hardly startled to hear Mel's approaching footsteps, but knew that a note accompanied every mail request, one intended to clarify, but even more so to remind. Racer, please call Brooklyn to ask some maintenance people to unpaint your lab's prop out windows so you can ventilate that sulfur. Here's a note to that effect. When Racer heard Mel's heavy door close, he knew the botanist had left. Thus, he'd have at least a day to address ventilation issues. Mel's departure left Andy, the stockroom assistant of Racer's only working companion. Andy had been promoted from status as an orbital floor polisher to one of stockroom assistant. His duties included checking out supplies and requiring that students initialize glassware breakage forms, making them responsible for both breakage or loss. Shoving the forms at students, Andy resembled a weird baseball fan seeking dozens of autographs. His tasks were complete 20 minutes into the lab period, allowing him to experiment with practical jokes that might serve to keep him awake until going home time. The previous term, he cruelly shared chemical packing popcorn with hungry lab students before revealing the odd snack originated as a packing material for bottles containing toxic chemicals. A reprimand was placed in Andy's HR file, and almost everyone agreed he would have been fired were it not for the fact that he and his wife, Olive, were raising a retarded son. Brooklyn had instructed Racer to keep Andy on a short leash. Racer couldn't leave until the last student had submitted results. Only one remained, a pre-nursing student whose roll book entries showed as GG or G. Short, Frankie Valley hair winged back to reveal attractive facial features. A light pink blouse sported upturned cuffs, revealing a wristwatch and a Link ID bracelet. Racer couldn't decide whether she was overly deliberate or perhaps slow. Although the female student seemed aware Racer noted her progress, she calmly continued, finally penciling in answers before a final review and handing the form to him for grading. The consequences of mistake were those of falsely indicating the presence of a metal not present, or perhaps worse, omitting one that was. Racer generally placed tildes next to correct choices and X's alongside mistakes. He shortly tilted agreement beside all four of G's choices. No X's, nor omissions. Good job, you batted 1,000. Obviously pleased, as G quipped, "Hey, I'm a softball girl, I know what that means. I'm familiar with iron and copper, but what about the other two ions, lead and antimony? What are their biological roles?" "You're correct. Iron and copper are potentially beneficial, but lead and antimony are both toxic. If you take advanced courses with us, we'll help you determine how much of them is present. We have two guys right down the hall, Drs. Gerald and Ash, who help us do that." Racer's weird name-dropping referred to the inventors of a machine that had revolutionized heavy metal analyses. The college's Gerald Ash invention, not its inventors, were present in Pittsburgh, NOH, Kansas. While G had needed fewer than 3 hours to correctly identify four chemicals, that process could take longer, much longer.